Welcome to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. I am Carolyn Freeman, and today I am chatting with Dr. Bridget Fuyun about relating with social AI, implications for the future. Bridget is a lecturer at Auckland University of Technology, a researcher investigating human beings' experiences interacting with AI social systems, a psychotherapist, and a speaker. Welcome, Bridget. I'm so delighted to have you on board.
Thank you.
Bridget, before we get chatting about the work that you do, can you tell me a little bit more about who you are and what the pivot point was that sent you down the road of cyber psychology and a psychotherapist and kind of looking at AI?
So I'm a registered psychotherapist, and when I was doing my psychotherapy master's, I became quite interested in people's relationship with technology. And I was researching mental health and social media use. And it was during that time that I noticed that there were a lot of studies on human and robot interactions, but more focused on the technology side and not really a lot focused on or giving attention to the humans using the technology and how it might be impacting them. So for me, this felt like a pivot point, and I was motivated to do my PhD on this even further. So, and my PhD was on the research of how humans experience AI digital avatars and social robots in an interactional context, and what is happening and how it might inform our future. Even though my research is through a psychotherapy lens, as cyber psychology is defined as the intersection of technology and psychology and people's interactions with technology, it's fair to say I've gone down the cyber psychology route.
In terms of your psychotherapy, how did you get involved in that, and kind of what did you specialize in?
So psychotherapy is a little bit different from psychology in that it's more focused on the unconscious, on very holistic processes, looking at different relational dynamics. It's very relational. I was interested in that because I actually did a psychology degree before, and it felt like something was missing. And then when I found the psychotherapy degree, I thought, yes, this is a fit.
Did you specialize in any type of psychotherapy?
No, psychotherapy is just either adult psychotherapy or child psychotherapy. There isn't a specification in that way, no.
So in terms of now the work that you're doing, your special interest is in mental health issues and human well-being. And you talk about related to digital technology such as social media and human robots and human digital avatar interactions from kind of the human experience perspective. What does all this mean? And can you talk a little bit more about this and the work that you do and kind of your insights into your interest?
So further on from the previous comments, my private practice, I've deal with a lot of clients from trauma to relationship issues and everything in between. And I've also noticed that from a sociological worldview, and from my research, that people's behaviors and language and ways of relating and engaging are changing with the different types of technology that's coming in. From noticing that with social media and smartphones and now AI as well. In New Zealand, it's more chatbots as opposed to robots. We don't have a lot of social robots here. I've also seen a lot of marketing hype around, you know, all these social AI systems, and it's been promoted as an answer to all our societal problems, with an apparent lack of curiosity or concern for questioning, is this technology actually beneficial for humans? Is this ethical and regulated? In other words, is it accountable? And has it been researched first before it's been released to the public? So those are the kind of things that got me really fired up and really interested in this. And so I've had very practical noticing from my clients what's happening in their worlds through to research and what's happening in the research world.
And you spoke in our initial conversation about New Zealand, because that's where you're based, and things like generative AI and AI, knowledge about AI. And I think you mentioned that there wasn't a huge amount of number of people who are using generative AI. Did I get that right?
There isn't a lot of AI literacy. So it's being promoted. All businesses, basically, you'll notice, have Gen AI built into their software and that. And it's getting promoted and people are using it without any AI literacy. And New Zealand's got no specific AI regulations. And I can talk a little bit more about that later on as well. But and so these are the things that are our problem here, is that when I've been talking to people, the public, about, did you know this about AI and this, and are you watching out for this? They didn't know these things.
So they don't realize, I'm assuming, that AI is behind a lot of the technology, digital technology especially, that they're using. And actually, say, for example, Netflix, do you think they don't realize that they are, or their behavior is being manipulated by AI?
Yeah, I think they know there's AI. I think they don't know the extent of how it's being used and how their information's being used. They don't know what to look for and how to make critical, informed decisions when using AI. I think that's the difference.
Okay. So do you think that there is an element of digital literacy that will that change how people engage or think about kind of human robot or human digital avatar interactions? Do you think that'll make a huge amount of difference? And how on earth will that kind of digital literacy happen?
So there's two aspects to this. One is really getting it out to public. So doing things like this podcast, doing other kind of public information sessions and things like that, along with the government adding regulations that can protect the public. So it feels like it's a two-sided thing. One, it's informing people, and it's also that the technology's been held accountable.
So there's a lot of people who talk about the government's needing to put guardrails in place for children, for adults, for us as who engage with AI. Do you think there's some element of awareness in New Zealand amongst the government representatives or in policies or ethics in any way, shape or form in New Zealand? Or is it just kind of they're ignoring it at this point?
The focus in New Zealand from the government in terms of AI seems to be really focused on pushing for economic development and using AI for that, as opposed to for public concern and looking at the mental health risks around that. So that is a big concern at the moment. And I am as part of the Psychotherapy Association, we are on the Public Issues Committee, and we're trying to get the government to really understand. There's been a lot of these open AI letters going to governments around the world, and we wanting to do one like that here for the government to start taking notice, but I'm not sure they will. We'll see how we go.
So from your perspective, I'm assuming that kind of letter to the government will be about, this is the impact of AI on humans, rather than this is the geopolitical advantage and the economic advantage of implementing AI in government and in the workplace.
Yeah.
And I think you're right, is that I've seen a lot of that. The mindset and the conversations and the narrative is all around, well, how can we, it's about energy, the amount of energy AI or generative AI uses, the amount of productivity that generative AI will increase, and how businesses can optimize generative AI in the workplace. But there's very little in terms of what is the human cost and what is the human impact. So we know, and even the human cost, they talk about, well, it's about job losses rather than what is a psychological human cost.
And relational as well.
And relational. I'm assuming that's the kind of thing that really needs the digital literacy in within New Zealand.
Yeah. And that's where government really needs to start listening to professionals that know about these things. And because this is going to be a problem down the road if they don't attend to it now.
And it's coming so quickly. We hardly know. Well, every day there seems to be another something coming at us. And there's another research that you conducted in 2024, and you developed a dynamic theory called embodied relating, which explains how human beings experiencing interacting with AI robots and avatars and kind of social chatbots, which feeds into human beings' developmental and innate processes and actions of relating to others socially. So this is both biologically and socially influencing these interactions. Can you talk about this? I've given a really sort of top line thing that I pulled off your Instagram, not Instagram, your LinkedIn post. So can you tell me what I've just talked about and also give a bit more detail about what this is and kind of the key findings from the theory?
What it is it's presented as a double helix. And that I found quite helpful in describing what's happening. So the double helix is actually talking about the each human user's interactional experience. So my key findings were that there were three theoretical categories that made up this theory. One was unconscious feeling. So that's the visceral sort of body response. Then there's conceptualizing. That's the sort of constructing of another. And that's more like through language and social concepts and how we relate in that way. And then the third one is fantasy becoming reality. And together, these work with subcategories. And that is buying into the hype, having expectations, embodying, developing trust, growing accommodating, projecting, anthropomorphizing, getting in a flow state, being lulled, and forgetting. Now, quite often, other research talks about up to, and in a roundabout way, up to anthropomorphizing. What I haven't seen a lot of is the getting in a flow state, being lulled, and forgetting. And that's the bit I found really interesting. What I noticed about that is that findings show that the development of social AI systems is taking technology from fantasy, so from the idea of it, into the reality through human users' experience and making AI believable and creating real imagination. So as AI social systems are being designed to interact with human beings, if the interactional experience is good, and that depends on all those subcategories, you know, if someone buys into the hype, if they feel this and feel that, then the human user gets lulled and forgets that they're even interacting with a chatbot, and that it doesn't feel like it's, you know, it feels real. So the human end users unconsciously feel the interaction, and the emotion of the experience stands out. So what is more important is the emotion of what they're experiencing compared to the facts of it. So that is how the constructing of the other can happen. And that's how people start to believe that these social AI actually understand them, are actually real.
What I've got from this is that if a human is interacting with the chatbots, they kind of, the first thing is that they get the, they hear about what's going on and that there is this whole chatbot thing, and they start experimenting, and then they go and engage with it. They see the response as being human-like responses, and they start then getting into the state where they start, they almost suspend reality and get into the state of forgetting that they are talking to a machine.
Yes. And so actually growing accommodating, that subcategory is, I've also described it as suspending disbelief. So you actually need to suspend disbelief in order to have the engagement.
How is this related to the Eliza effect? Is this kind of an extended or expanded version of the whole Eliza effect of just being, you kind of forget that you are talking to this machine and you start engaging with it emotionally? And this is this just an expanded version of it?
Absolutely. So if we look at the flow state, so if the conversation isn't lagging, if the AI is saying things that feel appropriate, there's a flow in the conversation that adds to the humanness and the human-like aspects of a conversation. And that then feeds into our unconscious, because unconsciously we have built in evolutionary processes on how to connect with others to survive and thrive. So this is just something that feeds into that. And that's what I talk about, that feeling lulled, because then there's the flow is going like this, and then it dips into forgetting.
There's some research that I heard about, it must have been last year, when they were talking about it's not so much the anthropomorphized elements, although those do play a part. It's more about, so the anthropomorphizing is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is about you associating human-like qualities to, say, a dog or a cat or a aeroplane or whatever it is. So it's inanimate object.
Yeah.
Or a car, exactly. Mm. So if we name a car, we start giving it those human characteristics and kind of start talking to it as though it's kind of sort of human. But what this research was showing is that it's more about the behavior that we see in the responses to the AI chatbots than our anthropomorphizing of the bot itself or the language model, which I thought was quite an interesting perspective of, it's more about it's showing human behavior or types of behavior and responses that are very human. And that's really what triggers your, or lulls you, I guess, taking your example into that state of believing that you're talking to a human.
Absolutely. And that's the thing, why one of my main categories is about the visceral responding, because there's a lot of neuroscientists that talk about the aspects that we don't even consciously acknowledge or notice that are happening in the conversation. And this is the thing that I think is important, because this is the thing that can be manipulated in people.
I wonder, and this is something I've been thinking about for a couple of months now, is how much we've been trained to engage with a bot, and whether or not it was consciously done or just so happens to be a extension of our previous technology engagement. And I wonder if this training has happened from the perspective of email correspondence, so the asynchronous / synchronous email correspondence or texting that we do with humans. We've become so used to chatting through text that it's a very small leap to start chatting with something that responds in a text format, and almost taking on that mindset that this is, it's easy to assume that it's human, and it's easy to give it that human-like quality, because we chat to people online all the time, don't we, in forums? We've never met them.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, there's another form of that, isn't it?
Yes. And so you'll see in my diagram, the fantasy part of that, some of that that's coming into reality is change in social norms. So an aspect of that is, which I've talked about as well, is the fact that, one, so it was emails, then it was social media. then COVID happened, and we all very quickly and easily moved online, doing online conversations. It was quite an easy slip into, and then it's a very slow and easy, very quick and easy slip into AI, especially if it's got a digital avatar that is human-like as well, because that adds another layer to it.
Exactly. Although this, going back to the Liza effect, doesn't take away from the fact that actually with the Liza effect, it was in the 1960s, I think. She says. And they hadn't had that training as such, but, and they were still engaging with this text-based machine as though it was human and starting to talk, open up to it. So it's kind of inherent, but also, as you were saying, it's quite really inherent in terms of social connection, but also we have been trained in our Western technological environment.
I think the thing was, with back in the 1960s, the people that engaged in that, it just shows you that, you know, we've been, as human beings, we develop so slowly, and if, you know, and so our capacity to engage and connect with others is just so innate. And technology is moving so fast. There's just, there's such a disconnect between the two.
I think I agree with you in that we not actually socially, emotionally equipped. And I think also we are kind of the younger generations who have grown up or are growing up with AI, grown up with technology, are probably able to adapt a lot quicker than older generations who haven't grown up with it. And kind of, it's not about a generational divide. It's, I suspect, more of a, we deal with it differently, being slightly older to the younger generations dealing with it. And I do wonder if maybe there is more of, kind of going back to your model, with the younger generations having slightly more of a suspended belief because they are so much more ingrained in this technological digital society.
Well, something else that I might talk about later is, I think something that's under investigated is people's relational styles, their attachment styles, and how they use technology. I think there's a quite a potential connection between the two. I've actually met people in their 19, 20 years old who say they don't use AI, they're not interested in using AI. So they are different. It's not like a generational thing as a whole. I think doesn't actually matter what generation you are, what attachment your style, and this is just a hypothesis, your attachment style, I think, might link to how you use technology.
Okay, so staying on AI chatbots, there's a lot of concern around chatbot use and the what you kind of term induced psychosis that comes from people spending a lot of time engaging with a chatbot. What is your perspective on it, and is there any advice you can give to someone who's either caught up in the psychosis or is really worried about someone they love or know who is?
So the first thing is to say that psychosis, in the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual for Mental Disorders, talks about it as a collection of symptoms that happens along with other mental health conditions. So psychosis is a disconnection from reality. So people may have false beliefs or experience things that aren't real. And you can get two types of psychosis: hallucinations, where the brain, parts of the brain mistakenly act like they would if your senses were like hearing something or seeing something, and delusions, and that's the false beliefs that someone might strongly hold. So you can also get psychosis that's triggered by something. So like alcohol, prescription medication, or recreational drugs, severe head injuries, traumatic experiences, and unusually high levels of anxiety and stress. So there've also been many reports that some people who interact with AI chatbots can develop a type of psychosis, or delusional thinking, where they present with false beliefs or experience things that aren't real. So I also think this might be something that might come up in the next version of the DSM, along with AI attachment disorder and AI dependency disorder. I'm wondering if those might come up, because there are signs that people become emotionally dependent. I've actually spoken to people who rely on AI to help them make decisions. They can't make decisions on anything in their lives without AI. People who are emotionally attached to their AI. So things like that. So then if we think about the clinical concern around AI and that it might act as a precipitating factor or a maintaining factor for susceptible individuals. Case reports and qualitative studies on digital media and psychosis show that technological themes often become embedded in the delusions. So particularly during the first episode, psychosis. And we can see this in social media, where the algorithms have already showed how automated systems can amplify extreme beliefs in a reinforcement loop. So this might also happen with AI. And it's interesting because although AI developers don't tend to design systems with severe mental illness in mind, their safety mechanisms are more around self-harm or violence. It does show that there's a gap between mental health knowledge and AI deployment. So I just wanted to say that first, but then let's have a look at the warning signs of psychosis. So early warning signs are not easy to spot. They can take different forms depending on the case of the psychosis itself. So sometimes early warning signs could be changes in emotions, like becoming suspicious or afraid or paranoid, changes in behavior, so avoiding usual activities or things like that, and changes in socialization, like maybe avoiding friends, staying in their room, things like that. So when it comes to managing psychosis, a common symptom with psychosis is a person's lack of insight. So there will likely be denial, and it means the person literally cannot recognize or understand the signs and symptoms of their condition. So a loved one who suspects that someone has psychotic symptoms or things like that, and it's important for them to recognize that the loved one who might have psychosis doesn't understand and can't see it. So the first thing to do is you can ask for help. People with psychosis or conditions like this could get mental health support. They can encourage them to see someone who can actually help. Like a professional person, don't judge and argue with them. People with psychosis have trouble telling what is real and what isn't. So if you argue with them, that'll just make them more fearful and want to isolate more and push away. Staying calm. So people with psychotic symptoms can feel afraid and frustrated when others don't seem to understand or believe them. So it's important to remain calm, to be in surroundings that are calm. If there's a lot of noise, to go away from the noise. And then, you know, if necessary, call emergency. People with psychosis and related conditions have a high risk of dying by suicide. If someone with psychotic symptoms says they're thinking about harming themselves or others, or if they show severe paranoia or agitation, or act abusively or violently, you should immediately call your local emergency services.
That is almost frightening in terms of AI exacerbating that element of psychosis or possibly bringing it on. And I wonder if that's part of what happens with those young people who either take their life or they start going down kind of dodgy roots in terms of the way that they think about themselves and the way that they act towards others. And do you think that this is part of that AI psychosis or the induced psychosis from AI?
Well, from the accounts that I've heard that have been made public from teenagers specifically, although there's been a couple of adults that have had similar situations, it seems to me that there might be an underlying issue, mental health issue for the person. Perhaps some sense of insecurity or loneliness or needing for validation or something like that. And it finds that initially in the AI. And then when that reinforcement loop happens, that's when the false beliefs can develop. People seem to be getting quite stuck in that and unable to remove themselves from that, but also unable, like, you know, some of the very sad messages that teenagers have left their parents is how much they desperately wanted their parents to help them, but they just couldn't ask for help.
What I found, going back to kind of the original definition you had of kind of psychosis, one of the things you used was hallucinations. And that's one of the terms that is used when AI, generative AI especially, makes mistakes.
True.
And and as you were talking about that, I was thinking, oh, that's how they talk about generative AI. So it seems as though it's kind of like a double hallucination in some ways. And there's an element of, as you say, there is probably for a lot of those people something inherently, or something they're inherently struggling with already, and this is just exacerbating it. And that feedback loop can exacerbate that element of hallucination. So it's kind of, I'm going to call it a double hallucination effect, just for the sake of making up terms, because Shakespeare did, so I can. And I wonder if there is that whole, it kind of plays against each other in terms of human hallucination and the AI hallucination. But the other thing you mentioned was that the DSM potentially coming out with new terms. Do you think that's something that may happen?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, that's a hypothesis of mine. The reason why I'm wondering about that being a potentiality is because we're seeing these things more and more. And I think the more cyber psychology develops, the more understanding of that, crossover between psychology and technology and what's happening, these are things we really need to consider.
I wonder if there's a way that we can influence the DSM. I think we need to. I think you need to send those entries in.
Well, I think you'll probably find in clinical settings there's a lot of people that are having these sort of ideas and suspicions that this is something that, if it isn't going to be, should be in there.
Right. We need to get those words trending somewhere on social media so the DSM sits up and takes notice. Okay, so you've been a psychotherapist for the past decade. What have you historically focused on in your therapy work, and what are you focusing on now, and why is that important?
So both in the past and now, it's really focused on trauma as well as relational issues of different types. And the thing that I've noticed is that how technology is changing people's relational skills and the issues that come with that. The other thing I'm noticing is a lot of people's self-confidence and social skills in relating with others is also changing. So more and more people seem to be communicating with the technology or through technology as opposed to in real time with each other. And the more they do that, the more it reinforces this insecurity or lack of confidence and how to manage real-time connection.
I agree. It's kind of that asynchronous versus synchronous conversations. I think asynchronous communication, which is talking like we're talking now, takes a lot of skill and time to develop. And I've noticed, and we've all seen this, is that children who are sitting in a cafe with their parents staring at a screen, and it does my head in, not from the perspective which I don't think they should anyway be staring at a screen for all day. But more than that is that they're not learning social interaction. They're not learning how to do conversation with others, how to negotiate disagreements, how to manage small talk, how to keep a conversation going, how to start a question, how to involve someone in the conversation, how to be empathetic. And I'm not a developmental psychologist, so I don't know all the details behind this. But I'm assuming that the vast majority of what children learn, especially in the first, I'm going to say 6 years, is really around observational, watching people do things. And if they don't get a chance to watch that one-to-one conversation.
And feel that.
Yes, exactly. And I get why parents do it. I absolutely do. Is that they want to have a conversation with their friend or their partner or whoever. So to give a child something to distract them, means that they can have the conversation rather than mummy, 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 mummy all the time. But it's taking away, I think, from that core developmental skills of conversation, face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball conversations.
There's two aspects to this. One is I do wonder if this is also around understanding and AI literacy and if those parents don't know the impact that it might be having or not having, then how would they know not to do that? So there's that part of it. The other thing that I've also been considering is that often children who are on the autistic spectrum, who cannot cope in social situations, their parents tend to give them a device to keep them calm. They put their headphones on and keep them calm in noisy situations. And so there's also this sort of walking the fence feeling of, you know, where is it helpful and where is it not helpful? And it comes to this understanding of, as well, and I'll come back to this again later on, around attachment theory and how actually in the first 3 years of life, attachment experiences, relational experiences, how much eye contact caregivers have, how much touch and interaction caregivers have with their child, what an impact that has for that child throughout their life.
So you're also a lecturer at Auckland University of Technology. What are you lecturing in? And if someone is interested in registering for either an undergrad or postgrad, how do they find out more about the university?
Auckland University of Technology is quite a mouthful. So we often refer to it as AUT. For AUT, you could go and have a look at their website, AucklandUniversityOfTechnology.ac.nz. So I'm the course lead and lecturing for the psychotherapy department and the graduate diploma for psychotherapy, as well as the master's program. So psychotherapy program, it's for professionals and volunteers who are individuals interested in becoming a psychotherapist. They usually have to have an undergraduate degree in a similar field to do the diploma. And it's focused on detailed understanding of human experience and behavior. It's the first stage of AUT's integrated psychotherapy program that leads to the qualification of a beginning psychotherapist. So once they've graduated from that diploma, they then can get accepted into the master's. And then from doing that, there's a practical element as well. And then they can qualify to be a beginning psychotherapist from there. But also if someone's interested in contacting me about what we've been talking about, you know, feel free to contact me on drbridgetfillion.com or on my LinkedIn.
That's brilliant, Bridget. Thank you so much for clarifying that. And I'll put a link to your website, drbridgetvuljoen.com, in the show notes. So thank you. Now, Bridget, what is the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
Well, for me, it's around attachment and relationships with family, friends, and community. So first of all, I'll say that attachment patterns in childhood have far-reaching effects on relationship skills and their mental representations in adult life. So attachment theory describes the evolutionary benefits of attachment, exploration, and fear that from childhood is help in regulating a child's developmental adaptation. So if we think about a secure attachment in childhood, is reflected in adult life by the ways in which people talk about their lives, their past, and in particular their relationships and associated mental pain. So if we think about the function of attachment behaviors, it's to seek safety from caregivers in times of stress, so or loved ones. A lack of felt security would lead to increased distress, you see. Now, if we think about the fact that, and there's been reports on this, that attachment alone doesn't predict depression, but that in combination with insecure attachment and excessive reassurance seeking predicts the more risk of severe depression. Now, if we think of excessive reassurance seeking, is that not what often happens when people interact with AI chatbots? They're looking for validation.
Now, do you think that this is all part of the digital literacy in a way of if parents know a little bit more about attachment and if they know a little bit more about how people engage with AI and all these really interesting conversations we've been having, do you think that parents will then potentially change their behavior towards how they engage with their children or and it, almost in the terms of self-realization, because we kind of don't know what we don't know. And if we don't know that this is what we're doing and this impact is having on our children, and this may be the future the consequence of it, do you think that parents may change the way that they do things?
I hope so. I think it all depends as well on what kind of attachment style the parents have. Sometimes changing from an insecure attachment to a secure attachment can only happen in a secure attached relationship experience. So there's that aspect. And I do think that if a lot of parents had more information, more understanding, more support around this, that would give them the skills or the knowledge on how to deal with these things.
Now, attachment theory, from memory of and my undergrad years, is that if someone who hasn't had a secure attachment relationship as a child, if they have a secure attachment relationship later on, that it's not kind of basically it's not a lifelong thing necessarily. They can have that secure attachment, but then almost heals that element of their self-worth and how their self-esteem and how they see themselves.
Absolutely, because what happens is as children, when we come into the world, our first experience of relationships is within the family of origin that we grow up in and how the adults interact with us in that relationship. As we go through life, we can in later life, either through therapy or some type of other relationship, have a secure attachment, which then can change one's perception and understanding of relationships.
So maybe that's also part of kind of going back to advice for people who potentially have a loved one or someone they know who isn't engaging a lot in this emotional AI interaction, is maybe there's an element of this is how you might be able to help them in terms of changing the perspective of that secure relationship or attachment, maybe?
Absolutely. I'll add that because the technology is being designed to the AI technology has been designed to respond to how humans connect and engage and our psychological traits, we should be maybe asking different questions, like what psychological traits might be impacting excessive use on AI systems. How do people different based on reality testing abilities experience these interactions? What interaction patterns correlate with distress? What, you know, cultural narratives are different for, so how does that influence the subjective experience? What type of attachment styles do people have that interact with these AI? There's a lot of different things that we could be looking at and asking questions about to give us more information on how to actually navigate this.
What I've got from our conversation, I think the overarching thing that I've got is that it's so nuanced in terms of how each person engages with generative AI in general, that to have, yes, there are theories and yes, there's specific things to look at, but there's so many elements that we don't necessarily take into account when we talk about a relationship with AI. And we kind of put a lot of people into boxes at this point, not because we don't know what all those nuances are yet.
Yeah. And this is where having psychological input is so important, both in the design and development of AI and also in the education of it and also in the regulation of it.
Absolutely.
And the research as well.
100% agree. Yeah. There's just not enough yet. It's not even close to enough, because it seems the majority of psychology research on AI is around creativity and how it's competing with our skill sets rather than how it's impacting us on us as humans and why.
And that's the thing, is that actually when you think about attachment theory, if you get the relational aspects right, if you get the feeling safe right, then you tend to get a lot of the other aspects right.
So thinking about all of that in terms of where we're at now, how do you see the future panning out in the realm of chatbots and social AI?
So a lot will depend on how social AI is or isn't regulated by governments and professional bodies, as well as the general public becoming more educated and aware of how AI is designed and how we interact with it. And remembering that, you know, the AI is designed to feeds into our evolutionary nature of how we are socially and emotionally. And therein lies the issue, because when these AI systems are flattering or sycophantic, they induce an emotional connection and even exploiting human vulnerability. And that's a dangerous combination without proper constraints. So in some countries, like in New Zealand, we haven't yet implemented specific regulations, and this is very concerning. So, you know, social AI systems are powerful tools, but when they like ChatGPT and that have prompts that lead to dangerous and sometimes life-threatening situations, no number of corporate reassurances can replace vigilance, transparency, and real-world safeguards. So across the world, you'll find there are countries that are having these discussions and ethical and psychological professions are talking about banning or restricting children's access to social media, social AI. Some are even saying no internet until a child is 16. So these seem like a lot of very challenging things that need to be worked out. But until meaningful steps are taken, parents can take an interest in their child's use of AI. They can review chat histories together and use parental controls where available. They can also talk about why seeking advice from AI can be risky, pointing to trusted alternatives like mental health, hotlines, peer support, etc.
Bridget, do you have any particular favorite books that you normally recommend to others to read if they are interested in finding more about this specific topic?
Yeah. So now I have some that, and they a variety. I mean, one of them is any of Sherry Turkle's books are brilliant. And although it's an older version, Alone Together has got some fascinating research and insights. The other one that I found, especially in terms of a cyber psychologist viewpoint to read, is the autobiography of Isaac Asimov. It's called I. Asimov. It's fascinating to read how he came about writing these science fiction stories about robots and things, and considering that a lot of AI developers turn to those science fiction story for inspiration. The other book that I found fascinating, it's edited by a psychotherapist. It's called Love in the Age of the Internet. And it talks a lot about attachment and how that plays out. The other one that I found interesting is by Aaron Balick. He's also a psychotherapist. And that's The Psychodynamics of Social Networking. The other one that I found particularly helpful as well was Technology versus Humanity. And so that's looking at ethical and moral questions around these topics. And as well as Relationships 5.0, and that's around how technology is reshaping our emotional lives. And then the last one is Mirroring People. This is by a neuroscientist called Marco Iacobi, and he looks at the science of empathy and how we connect with others. And I find that fascinating because he's talking about it from a scientific, neuroscientific perspective, but it also makes a lot of sense practically and psychologically.
I think I'm going to have to send you my Amazon bill. You'll be reading a whole lot of books in the next couple of months. Those are brilliant. I haven't heard about most of those, so thank you. Thank you very much for recommending them. And brilliant, Bridget, thank you so much for joining me on Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It was such a delight to catch up with you, and I really look forward to chatting to you again in the future.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.